Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a part of the 1517 Podcasting Network. You might wonder what that is. You have to go over to 1517legacy.com, check it out, home to over 8 podcasts, proclaiming the gospel through as many topics and mediums as possible. Bunch of great people over there. Thank you, fellows. Virtue in the Wasteland. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. Jagged Word. There's a bunch of things over there. Donovan Riley's got a new podcast coming out. Check it out. 1517legacy.com/podcasts. I am joined, as always, by Eric Sorensen. Eric, what's going on?
Busy week, as you might expect. It's Holy Week this week. We are recording in the midst of it, and so there's a lot to do, but this is my favorite week of the year. I mean, yeah. Holy Week is I love Christmas and all. It's good. I love the season of Christmas, but as far as just in the church year, I love Holy Week. I love Good Friday, maybe even more than Easter, maybe, as far as just like the actual service. You know, we typically have like a Tenebrae service. Right. Some of our listeners might not know what that is, but just basically, it's basically just a reading of the crucifixion with music interspersed throughout it. It's a beautiful, beautiful service. And but just busy getting prepared for all that stuff and, looking forward to also the week being over.
Right.
When you're a pastor, it's pretty busy. You're happy when Monday comes after Easter.
Yes, sir. All right, man. What do we got going on? Where are we at? We are close. We're nearing the end of the first book of 30 Minutes in the New Testament.
We are. And we are right in the heart of the crucifixion of Jesus. Again, we didn't plan it this way. I mean, we didn't like map it out. It just so happened that this week, on the week of Good Friday and Easter, we are right in the midst of the crucifixion. And so we pick it up at verse 45. It says, "Now from the sixth hour, there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, 'Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani?' That is, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?' And some of the bystanders hearing it said, 'This man is calling Elijah.' And one of them at once ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. But the others said, 'Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to save him.' And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit." Why don't we just stop there to take in some of the things that are in that brief paragraph before moving on. There's a lot here to discuss. I suppose first thing, just for clarification for our listeners, when it says from the sixth hour to the ninth hour, in Jewish thinking, that would be from 12 p.m. to 3 p.m. This, by the way, if many of you are familiar with this, but it wouldn't be unusual for churches often throughout history to have their doors open or to even have a service from that time, from 12 p.m. to 3 p.m., in honor of this moment where Jesus is on the cross. So so that's it, as far as the time frame goes. We know he's up there for hours. He is he is nailed before the world. He is shamed before the world. And then when it comes to the ninth hour, he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Dan, where is that from? What is he referencing?
Yeah, so you have Jesus here quoting Psalm 22, and this is actually the first words of Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? So this is David saying this. You know, Psalm 22 is a messianic psalm, and the rest of that psalm is just completely disturbing, for lack of a better word. It talks about sort of in vivid detail what Christ is going through as he's being crucified. What's interesting about it too is that, you know, David writes this in a moment where he feels forsaken by God, feels like God has left him, that God has abandoned him, which of course is not true, that God hasn't. left him or forsaken. But he is put. But what God has done through the Spirit is placed the words of Jesus into David's mouth, and because Jesus, who is ultimately going to say, my God, why have you forsaken me?" and have it be true, that this moment that God has turned his face away from his son, because that is true of Christ, it's not true of David. God has not forsaken David because for whatever reasons God may have to forsake David, they are all wrapped up in the person and work of Christ, who these words are ultimately about.
Yeah, it's important to note here. I mean, you know, theologians have at least said for many, many, many years that this is showing Jesus what happens as a result of Jesus taking on sin for us. I mean, this is the wrath of God is being executed upon Jesus to some extent here, where, I mean, it's as if the sins of the world are all placed upon him. And instead of punishing David, instead of punishing you or me, he is taking out the just punishment upon his son. So there definitely is a real forsakenness here. There's a real sense in which, for the first time, the infinite fellowship that the Father and Son have always had, in some sense, feels broken.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, everyone knows the passage of, hey, he'll never leave you or forsake you.
Mm-hmm.
That is true because of this.
Correct.
So that's I know, and you know, that God will not forsake me because he forsook Christ in my stead.
Essentially, what you're seeing here is 2 Corinthians 5:21 playing out.
Yes.
God made him who knew no sin to be sin for us so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. I mean, that's really, this is the great exchange taking place. So this right here, this moment, is when your salvation is won. I mean, this is when the work is being done. I mean, at the very end of what we read, where it says Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit, I mean, those words that he cried out in the other Gospels we find are, it is finished. It's done.
Right.
Accomplished.
Right. This is the yielding of his spirit is dying, of course. And this is the wages of sin. So this is the cashing of the check. So the sins of the world are placed on Christ, and his death is the death of the wages of sin. That's what it is. Now, of course, we all die, but we don't live as though death is some kind of a permanent thing, because it's not. As Paul says, we don't live as those who have no hope. We look at death and do what Paul does. We sort of taunt it. Like, where's your sting? Where's your victory? It's all been taken from you. And so we look at death as not something to be afraid of, not something that has any finality to it. I think it's remarkable that Paul does that. That Paul seems to think that that death is something that's totally worth mocking and scoffing at. You know, and you're only able to do that because of the death of Christ.
That's right. Yeah, it took the literal, I mean, it took the infinite Son of God going through this in order for us to be able to look at death and not fear it and not worry about it, not be controlled and dominated by it. You know, we have eternal life locked up secure because the Eternal One has taken upon death on our behalf.
Right. One of the other things you see here is they do this move with the sponge and the sour wine again. Again, this is not some kind of like sympathy move where he's crying that out, and some say, you know, oh, he's crying out to Elijah, and then someone took a sponge and filled it with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. This is shoving something in his mouth as he's crying out, not some kind of mercy play.
Yeah, you have to really let it just be what it is here, and that's exactly what it is. I mean, and it's interesting that they think he calls out for Elijah. Now, part of that is because you hear, you know, Eli, Eli, you know, Lama Sabachthani, when he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? They might hear him say Eli and think, oh, that's Elijah. It could be that. But there also is, I mean, something that's just helpful to remember that in Passover meals, typically, still today in Passover Seders, the prophet Elijah is invited to join them for the feast. I mean, so there's a little bit of a game played at Passover meals in which it almost, or like an empty seat is left at the table in case the prophet decides to show up. That is a thing. And so it could be in the context of this being that this is Passover weekend, that there's a sense in which it's like, oh, is he calling out for Elijah? You know, like we do at Passover time, is Elijah going to come? And so that's why it doesn't seem as strange to them, because it says in verse 49, others said, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to save him. Mm-hmm. So there really is a belief that like maybe he'll come back. And so that could be part of what's going on here.
Right. And obviously the reason that they think that way about Elijah is because he was taken up. They don't have a grave site for Elijah. He's taken up in a chariot of fire. So they presume that perhaps he could come back at some point.
Yes. Yeah. And just one more thing before we move on. I think it's important to note that the text says Jesus yielded up his spirit, mm-hmm. which is to say, it's just to point out, there's never a moment in this where he is not ultimately still God. He's not still ultimately pulling the strings here. I mean, so sometimes the way that we think about the crucifixion is we can sort of feel sorry for Jesus, or we can feel sympathy. And there's a part of that that's good, but not if you start to see him as sort of this unwitting victim. The fact is, like, he knew what he was doing. He wanted to do it. He did this. He endured the scorn of the cross for the great joy that was set before him. That's what the author of Hebrews says. So he knows exactly what he's doing here. And when it's time for him to yield up his spirit, that's when he yields up his spirit.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. This is no one takes my life from me, but I lay it down.
He lays it down. That's right. That's right. This is a willful thing. So now moving on to verse 41, what happens instantly after he yields up his spirit? And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook, and the rocks were split. Now, I'm just want to stop there, because the next part is really bizarre, right? I mean, it's a really, and it might take a little time to kind of sift through it, but what's the significance of the curtain being torn in two? It's a big deal, and specifically from top to bottom.
Yeah, well, the curtain is what is the dividing wall between man and God, or the holiness of God specifically, the Holy of Holies, right? And so access to God, which was only given to the high priests, and you and I could not go there, or any other Jews couldn't go in there. Essentially, what's happening is this is ripped all the way. It's ripped because access to God has now been made for everyone.
That's right.
That anyone can now approach God.
Yeah, there's no one that's you know, it used to be with the Holy of Holies, you know, only the high priest with the right kind of blood, right kind of sacrifice could go into such a place to commune with God. And so the symbolism there is very clear. Everyone's now welcome. Everyone gets access.
Right.
And again, the author of Hebrews will reference this sort of thing, where he'll talk about the throne of grace being open to us now. We can boldly approach the throne of grace. Not the throne of judgment, not the throne of holiness, but ultimately for us, it's a throne of grace.
Right, right. Yeah, this is where you have literally the wall of hostility broken down. Yeah. That you have no reason to approach God fearing judgment, because this dividing wall, this curtain, is torn as the judgment of God is poured out on Christ.
That's right.
Never to be poured out on you.
Correct. Never meant to be poured out on you.
Right.
Yeah. So now we move on. The earth shakes and the rocks are split. Matthew's gospel is the only one that reports what we read here. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. When the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, "Truly, this was the Son of God." Now, there are, number one, you probably haven't heard a ton of sermons on this last part that we just read, because it's strange and doesn't quite fit the narrative sometimes that people want to have of this passage or of this story. But Dan, what do you have to say about it? What do you think?
Whenever you have something that is just incredibly miraculous and seems just kind of insane and absurd, it's easy to miss the greater point that's going on. I think that this is actually fairly simplistic in the sense of what you have is you have death being defeated. That's what you have. When Christ dies, death is defeated. And what happens when he dies, this is what you see in correlation. When Christ dies, you have other people live, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have the bodies of saints, so people who died in faith in the promises of God.
Mm-hmm.
So these are believers, not specifically in Jesus, this person, but people that were trusting that God was going to send the Messiah, and people of faith. The tombs open up, and they come out. And all this is showing you is that those who believe in the promises of God, that cling to the promises of God, that death cannot hold them because of the death of Christ. And so it's no different for you or I than it is for them. We too will rise up out of our graves. That's what's going on here, is that you're seeing the power of death undone over those who believe in the promise of God.
That's right. Yeah, this is an interesting, I don't have much to add to what you had to say here, except that it immediately has the impact of converting people that weren't normally converted.
Right.
So, when resurrection happens, people like the centurion, verse 54, see it and go, "Whoa, there was something here. This is incredible."
Right.
So the symbolism here is very clear. Now, the question that comes sometimes is like, well, what happened to these people? I mean, they were raised from the dead, so you'd presume that they wouldn't like die again. Like, this doesn't seem to be the same kind of thing as like Jesus resuscitating Lazarus.
Mm.
This seems to be like people, Old Testament saints, raised up. And so some would say, well, maybe at the ascension, when Jesus ascended to heaven, these saints ascended from where they were at, and went to heaven themselves. Frankly, we just aren't quite sure. I mean, right. Exactly how this all works out. But that's the point, is not for us to, Matthew doesn't include it so that we can sort of speculate about, well, what about that, or what about this? The point is to say, this is what's coming for everybody as a result of what he's accomplished.
Right.
Resurrection is going to happen.
Yeah, I think that the only sort of maybe safe thing to assume is that these people weren't around for a long time. You never hear about them again. What happened after that, whether they were taken, went back into their graves, I don't know, but I think it's probably safe to assume that they didn't, wander the earth for the next 60 years or something like that. It doesn't seem like that's the case, but I think that the reason sometimes that we're not given details is because the details they cause us to further miss the point. And the point here is, we don't have any names.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who these people are. It doesn't matter. We don't know what happened to them. Don't know. Doesn't matter. That's not the point. The point is that dead people lived. That death,
that's right.
Death was undone. Death was defeated. The grave was overcome. That happened immediately.
Mm-hmm.
That death died at that moment, and that's what's being conveyed to us. So who the people are not important, other than the fact that they were believers in the promises of God. So we see that they're referred to as saints who had fallen asleep.
Amen. So verse 55, there were also many women there looking on from a distance who had followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. One just note here, it is interesting if you look through the Gospels, it's not just Matthew's Gospel, how prominent a role women play in the life and ministry of Jesus, not just at the resurrection. I mean, of course, there's the obvious fact that like women are the first ones to report the empty tomb. You know, that's a pretty significant piece of data. We'll probably talk more about that next week. But throughout his ministry, I mean, you actually have a passage in Luke that says that women were kind of like benefactors for him. That they were benefactors for the ministry. They were supporting his ministry. So some wealthy women of the time, which is, so there was quite a crowd that was following him, and it wasn't just guys. And I think sometimes you can kind of think like that with 12 disciples being all guys. In fact, there was an awful lot of women.
Yeah. We know the 12 disciples, we hear about them a lot, but the truth is there was like all kinds of people following Jesus around.
So verse 57, when it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who also was a disciple of Jesus. He went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate ordered it to be given to him. And Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen shroud and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had cut in the rock. And he rolled a great stone to the entrance of the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were there, sitting opposite the tomb. The next day, that is after the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember how that impostor said, while he was still alive, 3 days I will rise. Therefore, order the tomb to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people he is risen from the dead. And the last fraud will be worse than the first." Pilate said to them, "You have a guard of soldiers. Go, make it as secure as you can." So they went and made the tomb secure by sealing the stone and setting a guard. Now, there's a couple of things here. Joseph of Arimathea, don't know much about him, but shows up in the gospel accounts. It's very clear that there's no disagreement about this. It's his tomb. And to have a tomb that was like this, he would have had to have been a wealthy person.
Right.
Would have had to be a pretty significant person. He probably was known to the early church fairly well, because his name seems to be reported in a matter-of-fact way in the different Gospels. And, of course, what is the Pharisees' concern as they put Jesus in the tomb? Well, what if the disciples come and steal the body away?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, like, there's some hardened unbelief here.
Right.
I mean, like, the whole land goes dark and there's like an earthquake and dead people are walking around. They're like, man, what if this liar, what if his followers come and steal him?
Yeah, right.
And that's not the end. That won't be the end of the epic unbelief. This unbelief goes even further, obviously, when the resurrection happens. I mean, it just shows you the human heart will not believe on its own.
Yeah, the human heart will find a way to make excuses.
Right. Yeah, this is a very telling passage about the unbelief that is resident in the hearts of men.
Yeah, and incidentally, I mean, it's interesting that this is the excuse, or the reason they give here, is that people, they could steal the body. You know, they could steal the body. Well, there are some today skeptics that still hold to the same idea. The disciples must have stolen the body and hid it somewhere, right?
Right.
And of course, I mean, the problem with that is, I mean, there's a number of problems that we can probably talk about next week. But I mean, one of the problems is, just think about it from the disciples' perspective. What incentive do they have to do it? mean, there's literally no good reason for them to do that because it will only result in persecution. And you have to remember, I mean, they didn't have any, I think they're shattered. I mean, all of them have left him besides John. I mean, all of them have left him by this point. There just seems to be no incentive for them to actually like steal the body away. And we'll get into a lot of the different arguments for why it's, you know, reasonable next week to believe in the resurrection, but that excuse doesn't fly.
No, no. And, by the way, just as a side note too, Jesus being buried where he was buried is also a fulfillment of prophecy. One of the reasons Matthew is pointing this out, because as we said over and over, he's writing to Jews and he's being very intentional about showing all the things that Jesus fulfilled. And you do have in Isaiah 53, it says he had done no wrong and he never deceived anyone, but he was buried like a criminal. He was put in a rich man's grave. So you have the two things being done here. Isaiah talks about the death of Christ, and he was killed like a criminal. I mean, obviously, he was crucified between two thieves, but not buried like a criminal. He was put in a rich man's grave. I assure you that the average victim of crucifixion was not placed in a rich man's tomb. That's not how that worked. And so, so you do have this specific, I mean, pretty detailed fulfillment of prophecy by Jesus, where he suffers a criminal's death, but is buried in an unlikely place.
There is a sense in which the Pharisees show that they do have a little fear that just maybe this quote-unquote imposter might actually have the power to rise from the dead.
Yeah. I mean, how could you not?
Yeah. I mean, because I've seen him do all sorts of things that no one else has done.
I mean, even if they've seen him do all kinds of things, and like, of course, they attribute it to Satan. But even in that, maybe if they don't believe, which they don't, that he's the Son of God, they believe he's something.
Yeah,
I mean, you can't. He's not. They don't think he's normal.
Yeah, and so there's a part of this that's like, all if he comes back from the dead, I mean, what are we gonna say? We better come up with a game plan right now. Oh, well, I know what we're going to say. We're going to say the disciples stole the body.
Right.
That's what we're going to say. And so that narrative continued. That narrative continued after this, that the disciples must have stolen the body.
Right.
And Paul, as he's making the case for Christianity later, when he talks about the resurrection, one of the things he says is that couldn't be the case because this happened in such a public way that hundreds of people saw the risen Christ that it couldn't be the case that it was a stolen body. People saw him, and right, not just his closest disciples, 500 at the same time, he says in 1 Corinthians 15. So he gives these pieces of evidence to say, like, no, that can't be the reality.
Right, right. And that's it, man. We're out of time. Hey, it's good news that on this Good Friday that death has had all his teeth punched out, and you, like those who, at the crucifixion of Christ, will also rise up out of your grave. That is good news, and it's what makes Good Friday good. Guys, if you want to come hang out with us in North Dakota, which I know you do, if you're anywhere around there, May 19th, you should come hang out with me and Eric and Chad and Chris Roseborough and Daniel Van Voris and Cindy Koch and Ed Nugent. You should come hang out. We're going to be talking about the Psalms, and we are going to be talking about Jesus, because that's what the Psalms are about. So you can go over to ChristSoFast.org, go to the events page. You can get all the information there. We'd love to hang out with you. Hey, if you like this podcast, if it's been helpful to you, would you consider going over to iTunes, give it a rate, give it a review, and share this thing on your social media with your friends? All that stuff helps us a lot, and we appreciate it. Eric, I'll see you next week for the resurrection.
Sounds good. Happy Easter.